皮尔逊和美联社最新民意调查显示，中国和俄罗斯是最大的网络威胁。前美国国防部高级情报分析师点评如何应对。另外，美国新冠疫情大幅度下降，即将向完全接种者开放边界，我们走出险境了吗？大家好，欢迎收看美国之音的时事大家谈，我是叶凡。根据皮尔逊研究所和美联社公共事务研究中心的最新民意调查显示，大约四分之三的美国人认为中国和俄罗斯是最大的网络威胁。新冠疫情爆发以来，中国网络大军加强攻势，在社媒和网站上散布谣言和虚假信息，混淆病毒来源，诋毁西方民主。近两年来，中国网络信息战的手法和规模发生了哪些演变？谁是网络背后的操纵者？美国要如何反击来自中国的网络威胁？今天我们邀请前美国国防部情报局高级情报师、保护天下有限责任公司总裁丹·盖瑞特来谈谈他对这些问题的看法。盖瑞特曾经在美国国会行政当局中国委员会就2019年的香港民主运动作证。
Mr. Dan Garrick, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for the invitation.
China has ramped up disinformation efforts during the COVID-19 pandemic. So what does China's disinformation campaign focus on?
Well, China's disinformation campaign is a holistic, systematic, multidimensional, and multi-platform political warfare / information war against the United States and the West, and also targeting Hong Kongers, Tibetans, and Uyghurs, as well as Taiwan. It involves many different themes. So it has very large strategic themes, like China's new Cold War disinformation theme, accusing the U.S. of trying to initiate a new Cold War with Beijing. And then other ones like the U.S. attempting to stoke a color revolution in Hong Kong or in Xinjiang. Then also the COVID-19 conspiracy theories about Fort Detrick and the University of North Carolina, and a variety of other ones. And then,
but during the COVID-19 pandemic, China's message is more focused on highlighting and misrepresenting democracy's failures. Messages from China suggest that democratic countries' responses to COVID-19 pandemic have been disastrous, and China authoritarian states have managed their outbreaks very well. Did you notice that?
Yes, exactly. This is a part of its larger strategic disinformation campaign targeting not only the United States, but the Western liberal international order. It is integrated with the quote-unquote new Cold War disinformation campaign, but basically is a systems conflict. And basically Beijing is attempting to undermine the political legitimacy of democracy, as well as the United States government and its institutions as well. And as you indicated, try to extol the benefits of an authoritarian / totalitarian system, whether it be the People's Republic of China or the Russian Federation or Iran or North Korea.
Mm-hmm. And the other purpose is disputing the origin of COVID and
yes.
blame the U.S. for the pandemic.
Yes, and even within this disinformation theme, there are multiple streams of it. So you have disinformation regarding quote-unquote vaccine diplomacy, mask diplomacy, the politicization of virus origin tracing, and so forth like this. And once again, these are individual themes, but they are all underneath the larger strategic theme of discrediting the United States, placing and trying to discredit the theory or the hypothesis that the COVID-19 virus originated in China.
U.S. cybersecurity firm FireEye says in its new report, the scope of activity is much larger than previously understood. So what is the scope of activity in terms of languages and platforms used by China?
Again, it depends on the specific theme, but for these larger themes, it's very large. It's multi-platform, multi-dimensional. So we see disinformation in Chinese state media, both as in its so-called factual reporting, as well as opinion journalism. We see this replicated through social media accounts. So both overt accounts that are affiliated with like Chinese diplomats or Chinese culture organizations, as well as covert or illicit accounts, which claim no affiliation with the Chinese party state, but actually are affiliated. And then the FireEye report also talks to these automated bots, these coordinated networks, where basically where one party actor releases some disinformation, and then it's amplified throughout the network by other individuals. And eventually this percolates into the mainstream media. And so this is one of the metrics of success as far as the party is concerned, is how often its talking points and its narratives are regurgitated either in the Western media or by other more friendly nations media.
Do U.S. intelligence sources have evidence regarding who is behind this disinformation campaign?
Well, I can't speak to what U.S. intelligence has or doesn't have personally, since I'm no longer a member of that community. But speaking broadly and generally, since most of this disinformation campaign takes place in the public sphere, that data is out there. Now, the issue of attribution, who is responsible, is a very difficult one, much like with cyber warfare and hacking. You may be able to identify accounts or organizations that are prima facie involved, but who are the actual actors behind those accounts? This is a more complicated question. And while some of this can be ascertained to varying degrees of confidence through public open source methods like FireEye's research and other corporations, research like RAND Corporation, CNA, NED, Freedom House, that has documented Chinese disinformation, the more illicit the backstage activities, who's tasking the coordination generally will fall within the realm of national technical means or the classified intelligence capabilities of different organizations to be able to see who is providing the tasking, who's actually doing the coordination and so forth like that. But once again, it really depends on the specific scenario and the specific case. They may have some evidence. Sometimes that evidence may be circumstantial. Other times that evidence may be much more compelling. Another factor that comes into the equation here is whether it's law enforcement or an intelligence community or a political politicians or the media, there's different levels of there's different thresholds for evidentiary-based assessments. So one group may assess a certain type of information more confidently than another group. And there's different perspectives when they look at that data. So even like with the unclassified, the declassified version of President Biden's intelligence report, you know, it's been reported that there's been some disagreement within the intelligence community. Well, this is normal because each organization has different sources and methods and analytical frameworks that they use to evaluate that information. And so it goes back from the source of the information, goes back to actually what was provided or what was said, and it goes to the context, the timing, who said it, where it was said, and so forth like this. So it's a much more complicated issue than what Chinese disinformation has tried to present, which is basically to discredit the U.S. and Western intelligence agencies' research into this area as being basically politically motivated and unscientific. But this is a blatant disinformation claim itself, because at least in the case of the United States, the intelligence community consists of many scientists, including from the national labs and so forth like that. So this is not just a case of some political analysts sitting around reading some reports and making up a theory.
Have you noticed how Chinese disinformation operation evolved in the past 2 years?
For instance, U.S. officials have not previously noticed Chinese intelligence agency trying to spread disinformation through texting U.S. citizens. So that technique requires a very deep understanding of the U.S. infrastructure. How serious is that threat?
This is a very serious threat. And at a broader, more generic level, this kind of speaks to the issue of TikTok and the collection of very high fidelity information about American citizens and American residents. So these cyber intrusions that we have had in the past of OPM and everything like that, that provides very detailed information about individuals within the national security community or have clearances. And when you get down to a level where you're actually texting individual phone numbers, this suggests a very high level of information collection by the Chinese Communist Party and the sophistication in their targeting. And because generally what they're trying to influence is not the pro-China or the anti-China groups, but they're trying to focus in on that narrow group, that couple percent that are quote-unquote undecided. Same thing when it comes to U.S. political elections, because it's a two-party system. Hardcore Democrats and hardcore Republicans aren't going to shift. But those independents in the middle, there may be a certain percentage that can make the difference between a 1% win or a 1% loss.
How effective do you think the Chinese misinformation, disinformation campaign has been?
I think it's been very effective, much more effective than a lot of people realize, even academics and think tanks that are looking at this issue. Because once again, the Chinese disinformation campaign is a holistic and systematic approach. So organizations that are looking at just one part of the elephant, like perhaps Chinese disinformation targeting Taiwan, may not put that in context of other larger disinformation campaigns. It's also the case that when I did my doctoral work in Hong Kong on China's enemification and securitization, using political warfare against Hong Kongers, there was a great deal of disinformation that was apparent that nobody was reporting on. And even in 2014, it was obvious that Chinese and Russian independent media and state-affiliated media was cooperating and providing or circulating these disinformation narratives. Now we see that much more across the board, not only in social media and in propaganda, but also at the level of NGOs and groups and political parties in the United States and the UK. So you have a number of groups where the Chinese Communist Party has invited members to go visit China and meet party members, learn more, quote unquote, learn more about China. And then they come back and Chinese Communist Party officials may participate in webinars that are hosted by these organizations that are targeting demographics within the United States that may be amenable or susceptible to the Chinese message, Chinese Communist Party message, whether it is to not oppose the Chinese Communist Party's policies against Hong Kong or in Xinjiang, or even to try to improve the relationship between the United States and China.
Do you anticipate China will continue to drive higher engagement in this disinformation as WHO seeks to revive the origin, investigation of the origin of COVID-19?
Yes, they will ramp it up. And basically how intelligence agencies work is anytime that there's a crisis, they do two things. One is that they surge intelligence collection, and then they surge intelligence operations. So this is probably one of the most critical times in Chinese Communist Party's history or the rise of quote-unquote new China. So they will mobilize the whole of party, the whole of nation to discredit the investigation, to discredit individuals related to the investigation if they are not preferential to China's position. And we're already seeing that with some of the recent leaks of documents of individuals that were involved in WHO investigations that were actually cooperating with Wuhan Institute of Virology, basically discussing the types of bioweaponization implications that may exist. But if you look at Chinese disinformation attacking those individuals, they don't mention that. Or they may mention the U.S. individuals or the foreign individuals that were involved, but they don't mention that those individuals were working in cooperation with the Wuhan Institute of Virology at some level. So basically, you have a lot of duplicitous framing of the situation. So it may not be outright misinformation, but it is a definitely disinformation because it's on a partial presentation of the facts to China's advantage.
So how should U.S. counter this cyber threat from China?
excuse me. There's a variety of ways and things that need to be done. One is that I think Chinese state media cannot be allowed the same level of access to the United States media market or Western democracies that it has currently right now. The efforts of Twitter or YouTube to take down these accounts are ineffective and inadequate because the damage has already been done. And it's very difficult to stop them, stop new networks from popping up. It is also the case that the Chinese disinformation strategy has expanded. So because they are aware that Chinese state media has been identified as a purveyor of disinformation, they go to these quote unquote independent influencers on social media who ostensibly have no official affiliation with the party. So the US government and other governments need to look at how these clearly affiliated actors are licensed or not. Basically, they're foreign agents. So what we have in the case of the China Daily or the People Daily or Global Times is we have individuals who are commentators, routine commentators, if not columnists in those party magazines that are hosting webinars that have social media accounts and they're hosting discussions. They're basically pushing Chinese Communist Party talking points and disinformation themes, but these accounts won't be banned because they're not state affiliated per se, but they're actually part of the party state united front apparatus. So the United States and the West really needs to look more deeply, not just at the technological solutions or the technological threat, but also the human based threat that comes out from the united front co-optation of the West.
Thank you so much, Mr. Garrett. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
好，非常感谢前美国国防部情报局高级情报师丹·盖瑞特为我们做的分析和解答。来宾发表的都是个人意见，并不一定代表美国之音。接下来，美国即将向完全接种疫苗的人开放边界，我们走出险境了吗？请不要走开，我们马上回来。欢迎回到时事大家谈，我是叶凡。近两个月来，美国新冠感染人数大幅度的下降。美国疾控中心宣布，在11月即将向完全接种美国监管机构认可的疫苗的人开放边境。认可的疫苗包括中国科兴和国药疫苗。什么原因导致近来确诊人数显著下降？我们走出险境了吗？随着默沙东集团的新冠口服药等治疗手段的突破，离开疫情的终结还有多远？今天我们邀请圣地亚哥格罗斯蒙特医院主治医师傅阳恒来分析和解答。傅医生，非常感谢您参加今天的访谈。
非常高兴又和大家见面了。
那自从八月底到九月初以来，美国每天新增的确诊新冠住院和死亡人数呢，都分别下降了35%、25%和10%。世界卫生组织的数据也显示，全球每天新增的新冠确诊人数也下降了超过30%。傅医生，这是什么原因？
我觉得主要的原因是因为这个人群的免疫增加了。因为的话，这个冠状病毒的话，它的所谓群体免疫，这个就是可能至少要90%以上。即使90%以上，你还是能够被感染，但不一定会得病。那美国现在目前大概57%的人打了两剂的疫苗，就是有人估计，在美国至少50%的人得到自然的感染。但当然，自然的感染中间可能有50%的人呢也去打了疫苗。所以呢，总的说来，有我们这个算数一算的话，这个大概有82%的人 打的这个就是已经有了身体的自身的这个免疫力，就是目前这个美国群体免疫是这么一个状况，所以这是主要的一个推动的原因，为什么这个病例在下降。当然还有一些东西我们不知道的，我们就没办法说了。
那自从这个九月初美国的这个小学中学开学以来啊，学生都返回学校了，这个没有影响总体的这个新冠确诊人数，那很多小孩12岁以下的到目前为止还没有打过疫苗，为什么这总体的新冠感染率并没有上升？
实际上的话，儿童的这个感染率在过去就是在这个 Delta 来的之前呢，儿童的这个感染率总是大大的低于成年人，但是呢最近由于成年人的免疫力增加，现在儿童也增加了，儿童现在实际上他以这个年龄段的12岁以下的这个年龄段目前已经占了这个总最近的话已经占了总感染数的 27%， 所以他实际上已经高于目前的其他年龄段的，如果你按年龄段来分，他这个小孩现在实际上已经赶上来了，就他并不是少，但是呢儿童他的感染的一个特点是什么，他很低，他的病情很低，他实际上传染性被感染和传染别人的这个可能性呢，可能跟成年人的可能是差不多的。
有研究人员说，这个现在这个下降的趋势啊，符合所谓的两个月的周期，也就是在很多国家出现过的这个感染人数飙升两个月，然后又下降两个月这样的规律。比如说在印度、英国和法国等国家都有很明显的这样的一个周期。那傅医生如何来解释这个所谓神秘的两个月周期？
这个周期问题是有人注意到，主要我觉得这个周期是由四个因素决定的。第一个就是病毒的传染性和它的毒性，第二个是这个人体的免疫力，第三个是人类的行为，第四个就是一些环境因素和我们不知道的一些因素。那如果我们把美国的这个到目前来讲，我觉得是有三波，它不一定符合正好两个月，但是呢确实有三个波出现。第一个波的出现是去年三月份的时候，刚刚开始的时候人群的免疫力是很低的，病毒的传染性并不是非常强，原始的株它并不是很强，但当时呢刚开始的时候呢群体没有预防，大家都没有准备，所以呢这个免疫再加上免疫力非常低，人类的行为又不行，所以呢就造成了第一波的出现。但第一波出现之后呢就很大家就造成恐慌，以后呢人类的行为就改变，所以第一波就下来了。当然了，到第一波中间到了这个国庆节的时候，七月份又有个小的上升，我们不知道有没有图片可以看一下。那从这个方面来讲的话呢，我们就出现了这个第一波。那第二波的话，就是因为这个美国的民众当时他对这个病毒又放松了，大家觉得说，哎，夏天来了，这个病毒就没了，所以大家又放松了警惕性。再加上国庆节，所以呢，这个。这样子当时的英国的一个猪也开始出现，所以这个时候就开始又飙升，所以第二波的话它飙升到了这个感恩节又升上去，圣诞节又升上去，到元旦又升上去，然后呢三月份四月份五月份六月份又开始下来。这个时候呢我觉得主要原因就是因为后来人体的免疫力增加了，再加上大家戴着口罩，因为一开始美国人是不戴口罩，但是后来大家都戴着口罩，所以呢这个加上很多户外活动，所以这个病又下来了。那我们现在经历的这个是第三波，就是因为印度，因为它的 Delta 病毒它来了以后，它这个 Delta 病毒造成现在美国几乎100%的至少说99%嘛的病毒株都是 Delta 株，所以呢这个株现在又上来了。那上来到现在呢我们可以算一下，就是说美国现在已经有57%的人，被感染，被接受了免疫，另外至少有50%的人被感染。那被感染中间可能有一半的人也去打了疫苗，所以我们这个算数一加起来，大概美国大概现在目前这个2%的人，如果你去测的话，82%的人，他应该是抗体是阳性，所以这些人就具有一定的免疫力了。
所以随着我们对这个病毒的认识加深了，然后采取了相应的免疫这个防疫措施，再加上我们的治疗啊什么也都慢慢的跟进了，所以这个 确诊的人数下降了，那您认为如果我们照着这样的一个防疫措施来做，我们能不能突破这个所谓的循环？
这个循环只是它这个波峰会越来越小，被感染的人群会慢慢一直在减少。假如没有新的这个变异株出现的话，它这个循环我觉得它不一定是两个月，就是这个周会慢慢一直减少，到最后达到一个平衡状态。
嗯，那现在新加坡对打了两针疫苗的人开放了，美国也宣布要从十一月开始，接种了美国监管机构认可的疫苗的人呢也可以入境了，那这个其中也包括接种了中国科兴和国药疫苗的人，那是不是现在这个放弃清零是一个趋势？您怎么看这个做法？
我觉得新加坡的情况是这样子的，新加坡它过去是清零的政策，但现在新加坡它达到了一个就是说法清零的程度，最近这一两个礼拜新加坡的病例一直上升，它在上升的趋势。那新加坡的话 84% 的人打了疫苗，但是它的人群中的感染数很低，可能低于 5%， 所以呢这个新加坡的加上你打了这个 84% 人打疫苗，这疫苗不是，假说它的有效率是在 85%-90% 之间，那你大概就是新加坡大概还有 75% 的人是有免疫力打了疫苗，但是呢还有 25% 的人是易感人群。在 Delta 病毒这个需要 95% 以上保护的情况下呢，新加坡它现在面临的是严峻，它实际上它的病例是在增加。当然说新加坡它要开放还有很大的原因，就是一个是精神的疲劳，就是民众啊所有的人啊大家对这个病毒已经感到一种精神的疲劳，认为说算了吧，感染就感染了，就大家都不愿意再去做这种很繁琐的这种保护措施，再加上一个经济受到影响很大，所以呢新加坡它现在开放它是主要的原因是因为它已经无法清零了，这是一个原因。第二个原因就是我们讲了它已经有不少的人已经有了保护，他们的医疗条件非常好，所以它是有控制的开放，它只是让打过疫苗的人进入美国进入新加坡，并不是让这些什么高危群的这个国家的人来他们新加坡，他没有这么做。那美国情况不一样，因为美国在好转，美国为了也有这个疲劳问题，当然也有一个这个经济问题，所以他美国现在要开放，十一月份要开放，美国他，所以说这个也是一个自然必然的趋势。
嗯，所以说这个开放从长期来说是有好处的，虽然近期可能会有一点小升高。但傅医生，现在这个美国的制药公司默沙东集团在研究这个新冠口服药方面又有了突破，他已经向美国 FDA 申请了紧急使用授权。那您怎么看这款口服药对这个抗疫的作用？我们是不是已经脱离了险境了？
对，这个药我先简单介绍一下，就是这个药它跟这个 Remdesivir 就是人民希望它的作用机制是一样的，它主要是这个抑制这个病毒的这个 RNA 酶。这个药优点就是口服，但是它必须在五天内得病吃了这个药才会有效果，它能够减少这个住院率 50%， 也是减少死亡率。它这个对照组的死亡率就是说有八个人死了，但是吃了药的人他没有人死。那但是这个药要2000块，所以我们碰到的病人呢，就它局限性在哪里呢？就我们碰到病人大概50%以上的病人他都是7天以后才来找你，加上你的诊断啊要24小时核酸检查，这个所以说这个就很多延误。但最最担心的是这样，就有一些人他不愿意打疫苗，现在他说哎我有了这么一个药，他就是说哎我有这个药来保护我，我就更不打疫苗，这就是他的一些局限性。所以呢这个药我觉得他对整个美国的疫情他不会有太大的影响。
嗯，好，非常感谢你傅医生。那非常感谢圣地亚哥格罗斯蒙特医院的主治医师傅阳恒为我们做的分析和解答。来宾发表的都是个人意见，并不一定代表美国之音。感谢收看《时事大家谈》，我是叶凡，下次节目再会。